Father William Gill is an ordained priest of the Church of England. On June 25, 1959, Father Gill and dozens of his native parishioners at the Papua Mission in New Guinea witnessed an aerial phenomenon that to this day defies logical explanation. The strange object they saw hung in the air hundreds of feet above the ground for almost 4 hours, according to Father Gill.
You could describe it, I suppose, as a circular ship with a kind of deck and bridge on the top. A big circular ship, which wouldn't be very far removed from one's idea of a hovercraft, but no noise. It was a dull yellow, a bright orange-y colour. It wasn't as though the thing was itself lit up all around. It was more as though some other light was lighting it up. It didn't look as though it was like an electric light bulb, the light coming from within. And then all around the whole object was a sparkling effect.
The following night, the strange object returned. And this time, Father Gill, along with 38 Papuans, noticed what appeared to be the silhouettes of occupants aboard the craft peering down at them.
When we saw this object, and we saw figures on it, moving about, trying to do something, one of the natural reactions would be to wave. And this is what I did. I waved with one hand, and a figure seemed to wave with one hand back, with one arm. And then Ananias, the teacher standing next to me, he waved in the same sort of fashion, waving his arms across. And again, a figure seemed to do the same. It seemed as though this figure was bending over a deck or a rail of a ship and simply responding to our waves. We couldn't make out any details of face or whether they had hair or anything like that. It was more as though they were in a diving suit. I sent Eric, one of the schoolboys, down to the house for a flashlight to see if we could getting acknowledgement with a flashlight. We flashed the torch on and off, and it just seemed as though to us that the whole of the ship moved sideways as a pendulum, not very much, but just a little to the right and then a little to the left, as though it was acknowledging the flashes of the torch. And that ceased after about half a minute. The next major event was when we tried to encourage it to land. We beckoned, but it didn't. And the creatures on board seemed to lose all interest in us. They seemed to be more intent on working on whatever they were doing. This is assuming they were working, but it appeared to us that they were doing something on the deck, fixing something or doing something, and they seemed to be more interested in that than us. When it did disappear, it seemed to disappear to very quickly, in that it either went off very quickly, so that in a matter of half a second or so, it was a large craft, which one might imagine about 30-odd feet in diameter, down to a pinhead and nothing, all within about half a second.
Dr. J. Allen Hynek traveled to Papua New Guinea to personally investigate Father Gill's sighting.
I was successful in finding six of the original native witnesses who confirmed the story. I think one of the highlights of that whole event was the fact that Father Gill and the natives did not take it too seriously when it was happening. In fact, Father Gill told me when he was a guest at my home that he felt it might have been some strange new device of you Americans, as he put it. I thanked him for the compliment, but I assured him that we Americans did not have any device that could hover several hundred feet in the air silently and then take off at a rapid speed.
2:25 a.m., December 3rd, 1967. Ashland, Nebraska police officer Herbert Shermer radioed a call for help to the sheriff's dispatcher in the nearby community of Wahoo.
408 Wahoo, 408 Wahoo, there's an object in front of me with red flashing lights. I'm getting closer, The object is taking form. It's of a disc shaped. 408 Wahoo. I need some help down here. I don't know what it is. It's moving over the left shoulder of the road.
The sheriff's department never picked up another transmission from Shermer. And because the nearest patrol unit was at the opposite end of the county, Shermer was left alone at the intersection of Highways 6 and 63 to face the unknown.
The radio went dead. There was a flash of white light came from the object that has moved to the left shoulder of the road, and it seemed as if the vehicle and myself were being pulled to the left shoulder of the highway. The next thing I remember, I was up on the embankment in the field, standing outside the patrol car by the driver's side, watching this large object, legs retract, like a tripod retracting. There was like a catwalk around the outside of the craft, which was spinning, and there was an orange reddish glow coming from beneath it, giving off a real brightness, whistling sound, and it seemed to just lift up and then shoot directly out of sight.
As he compiled his official report of the incident, Shermer realized he could not account for almost 30 minutes of his time. After passing four state police lie detector tests, the missing time remained a mystery. Hypnosis provided the answer.
When the flash of light came from the object, the vehicle was pulled with a force up the embankment where the craft landed. A hatch opened up from the underside of the craft. A tube came down. And a platform slid down. This, I call it a ladder. So this being comes down and walks over to the front of the patrol car with a black object in his hands. And it seems as he presses it, a green, flashy, like mist, sprays over the vehicle. I can't move, I can't do nothing, I'm just looking. Another being walks to the driver's side of the patrol car. My window was rolled about halfway down. The reason for that was to hear noises at nighttime when you're cruising real slow. He reached inside the window, and in his, I'd say his right hand, he had a shiny object he depressed against the side of my neck, which gave a tingling sensation down my neck, spine, into my legs. He opened up the vehicle door. I stepped out, and he says to me, "Are you the watchman of this town?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I am." And he says, "Watchman, come with me."
Shermer described the aliens as almost human in appearance, recalling in particular the one he believed to be the leader.
I would say that his flesh tone would look like a man who'd been out in the desert and really copper tone burned and shaven where it looked gray textured, you know. It would look like that. He had a very small mouth. His mouth didn't move. It seemed like he spoke with a deep voice, you know, like person talks real deep voice, you bring everything out. He spoke like that. The fellow, it seemed like they were talking with the telecommunication. He was about 5.5 feet tall, maybe 5'7". Broad-shouldered, muscular. His age appeared, I'd say about, at that time I was 21 years old, I would say to me at that time he looked to be about 50, 45, 50. He had a large forehead, long nose, he had heavy, dark eyebrows. His eyes were the same as our eyes would be, except for the pupil of his eyes were slit like a cat's. There was a hood covering his head like he had on a jumpsuit, and it was sort of a silverish-grayish color. One side of his head was sort of like a lump, like a black box there with a small antenna sticking out of it. On the other side, you could see the form of the ear. He had on a black belt, black gloves, and black boots. And he seemed to have sort of like a holster, a black holster on the side of his hip, which I couldn't tell what was in it. And on his left side of his uniform was a diamond-shaped patch with a winged dragon on the patch. Each one of them had one.
Shermer was then led up the ladder and into the craft.
The first level of the craft that we were in was a large circular room with large, like 55-gallon drums, canisters all the way around this room, with like a brass cable weaved through the top. And in the center of the room was computers, a couple of platforms, and the overhead ceiling was a large cone-shaped object which was spinning, floating freely in the center of the room, giving off a sort of a very light reddish glow. And I said, "What is this?" And he said, "This is how our craft operates." And I says, "What do you mean?" He says, "By reversible electrical magnetism. One of the purposes for us landing here was to extract electricity from your power source." And he says, "Follow me." And we walked over and out of one of the port holes, this one pressing buttons, and a blue boat shot out to the pole. It seemed like for about 60 seconds. Then it came back again. The boat came back again, like for about 60 seconds. And then it quit.
He was then taken to the craft's second level, which he estimated to have been at least 40 feet above the ground.
There was a large, the same size as the other room, but many, all kinds of computers, charts, graphs. There was like a large screen. We walked directly over to that. And as we were walking, I noted that there was another being opposite of him at a panel. And he pressed some buttons and he showed a group of stars off in the distance and said, "This is where we are from, a galaxy, next to your galaxy." Watchman, he says, "One day, you yourself will see the universe as I have seen it." And told me that I would not speak wisely of what I've seen or what I heard when I left. And then he escorted me outside of the craft to my vehicle, where I turned and he touched my shoulder and I touched him, and then I knew that there was a real sensation there. He went back to his craft and took off.
There had been a 5-minute power failure in Ashland, Nebraska that night. In addition, a charred power pole was found about 200 yards from the landing site. Its transformer burned out. 9 other people reported sighting a strange light in the sky that evening, but Herbert Shermer took the brunt from skeptics and debunkers. He was eventually forced to leave the town in which he had grown up. Because there are no known witnesses to corroborate Shermer's testimony, we turn to PSE expert Charles R. McQuiston.
We have about 15 charts up there, and as I said, I can't find any holes in his story. This is by far the most specific instance in terms of details, like the patch, the arm patch, and the winged dragon. And usually these people don't go into such specific detail, but he does it, so I have to believe his story, because there's nothing in the charts that would refute what he's saying.
January 6, 1976. Elaine Thomas and Louise Smith had treated their friend Mona Stafford to a birthday dinner at a restaurant 30 miles from their homes in Liberty, Kentucky. Around 11:15 p.m., as they were driving back, they became dizzy. Their heads ached miserably. Looking up, they were horrified to see a huge, brightly colored circular object hovering over their car. Louise Smith lost control of the vehicle, and the next thing they knew, it was almost 2 hours later, and they were 12 miles further down the road. When they returned home, Louise Smith noticed a burn mark on her neck.
"And my neck was burning. Oh, it was hurting so bad, you know. And I asked Mona to look at my neck. And then we all got to comparing, you know, because we were all burning and hurting, you know. And Mona's eyes, they were something terrible. So we looked at our necks, you know. I looked at Mona's and all. We each had a mark on our neck about 3 inches long and an inch wide, that just the top layer of skin looked like it had been removed. So I looked at my watch to see what time it was, and the minute hand was going as fast as the second hand should have been going, completely malfunctioning. I picked up my alarm clock and it starts doing the same thing. Everything I touched went haywire, you know. And when I went into the bathroom and started to wash, I burned just like, well, it was almost like I was scalding myself, you know, from the heat. And so we did go to the doctor, and he told us that we definitely was exposed to something like radiation that could have been the reason for the burning. for the hurting in Mona's eyes, you know, and all of this.
Dr. Leo Sprinkle, an associate professor of psychology at the University of Wyoming, heard about the experience and agreed to try hypnotic regression on the women to help them recall the time for which they could not account. Listen closely to this exclusive portion of Dr. Sprinkle's original hypnotic interview with Louise Smith, and note her anguish as she relives the experience.
It was right over.
It was right over you? Okay.
What is it? Oh. It looks like it's going to crash. God, what is it?
Didn't know what it was. It was really frightening. Mm-hmm. What happens now?
I don't want to look at it no more.
So frightening, it's hard to look at.
Yeah. I'm so bright. My eyes hurt.
The light hurts your eyes.
Yeah. I can't control my car.
Can't control the car. No. That's frightening because you can't control the car.
There's something wrong with it.
Uh-huh. What's happening to the car?
I want it to keep going. I can't hold the wheel.
Mm-hmm.
I want Mona to help me.
Uh-huh. You want Mona to help you hold on to the wheel?
But I don't have my foot on the gas.
You have your foot off the gas pedal?
Not on there.
And still the car's going?
I'm going 85 miles an hour, Mona.
So the car shows it's 85 miles an hour?
Mm-hmm. What's wrong with my car?
Can't understand. It's hard to understand.
What is it?
Leonard Stringfield, a former Air Force UFO investigator, now affiliated with the Mutual UFO Network, was present for several of the hypnotic sessions.
The contortions and the crying that these women showed, you know, during the hypnosis, and it would make a believer out of you.
It took Dr. Sprinkle several tries at regression to extract the terrifying details of the missing minutes. Louise Smith ultimately remembered waking up on what seemed to be an operating table with strange creatures peering down at her.
They were about 4 to 4.5 feet tall, and they wore a dark, tight-fitted suit and a hood. The hood was tight-fitted also, you know. The only thing visible was the eyes. They were very huge and pointed more to the temple, not straight across like our eyes would be. There was an odor. It was almost like a mold. Have you ever smelled a refrigerator that's been fastened up that with no electric for a long time, you know? And you open that door and you get this kind of moldy smell. I smell that. And I have never been asked this question, but now is an opportunity to bring this out also. The odor itself, I smelled stronger when the beings were near me. And when they looked at me, we did not talk verbally like we're talking now. It was a telepathy type thing. And I would tell myself I'm not going to look at them, but there was no way I could resist, you know. And then at one point, they poured a liquid over my entire body. And I thought I was going to die because I could not breathe. I could not breathe, and it was so hot, you know. So then when they pulled it off, it was like ripping a piece of tape, you know, from the body and the skin. And what that was for, other than I get so frightened, I think maybe they were making a mold, you know.
Dr. Sprinkle sums up the questions raised by the Kentucky abduction case.
Are they physically real? Are they psychologically real? Or both. We know they're psychologically real in the sense that the person's have described events which are significant to them and which have caused some changes in their lives. Whether they are physically real, the evidence suggests that. For example, burn marks on the back of the neck of the women, symptoms, loss of weight, sleeplessness, irritability or arousal of anxiety. So we know that they are experiencing physiologically some stimulus. What we don't know is, does that mean that they were taken on aboard a flying saucer and examined physically, or were they psychologically programmed to have that kind of experience?
Psychological stress evaluation expert Charles R. McQuiston has meticulously analyzed the actual witness testimony of the close encounter cases you have just heard. Here are his final conclusions.
None of these cases that I've run would indicate anything like a hoax to me. A couple of them were pretty liberal in their translation of their experience. In that degree, you might say, well, it's partially a hoax because it isn't completely the truth. The one common factor is that they have all experienced an extraordinary thing. And some of the things done to most of these people in terms of alien contact, touching, feeling, and the discomfort of mental communication, as they describe it, are pretty graphic to them. And they have described this in varying degrees. We have a wide range of personalities here. We have a fairly wide range of intellect and formal education. Yet, in their own fashion, they are describing what they believe to be true.